During the course of this presentation, I have argued that spirituality is that dimension of the human experience arising from one's relationship with reality. I have also argued that all human relationships are rooted in understanding, and that all understanding is ultimately rooted in reductionist thinking. I have further argued that the concept of God itself is a non-reductionist concept. Now, if my arguments are correct, then we are faced with the unavoidable conclusion that a relationship with God is impossible. Can you see that? The very claim itself is self-refuting. It's internally inconsistent. It's impossible. Be that as it may, billions of people the world over insist that they enjoy a close, personal relationship with God. Now, what's going on here? How do we account for the almost universal popularity of a belief in God? Over the years, people a whole lot smarter than me have attempted to answer this question. Some have argued that a belief in God has survival value, that it gave ancient societies a common, unifying purpose, something to rally around. Others have speculated that humans invented concepts like God and the afterlife to help them cope with a pressing awareness of their own mortality. Still others have suggested that the human brain is simply hardwired to believe in God. I'd like to share with you another possibility. This is not a new explanation, but it's one that has fascinating implications when considered in the context of our present discussion. The explanation goes something like this. The desire to believe in God is an emotional vestige from early childhood, a sort of leftover emotional craving looking for something to attach itself to. This emotional craving has roots, like everything else about us, in our evolutionary past. Evolution is a game of survival and reproduction. To stay in the game of evolution, an organism must first survive to an age when it is capable of reproducing, and then it must successfully reproduce. Those are the rules. And any organism that fails to play by these rules is out of the game. Ponder for a moment that the single most important reason that you are alive today is because all of your billions of direct ancestors before you, without a single exception, played by the rules of this game. Now, I'm not trying to put any unnecessary pressure on you or anything. I'm just calling to your attention what I think is a rather astonishing fact. In light of this astonishing fact, it should come as no surprise that among the most powerful emotions we experience are fear and lust. These emotions drive us to engage in behavior that help us stay in this game. Fear drives us to avoid animals with sharp teeth that might kill us before we grow old enough to reproduce. Lust drives us to reproduce. These emotions are absolutely crucial to our survival. But there's another emotion that sometimes gets overlooked. And like fear and lust, this emotion is absolutely necessary for our survival. This is an emotion that drives us to latch on to some big person. You see, there was a period of our lives, from the time we were born through the first few years of life, when we were completely dependent on some big person for our survival. These big people were typically parents, although they didn't need to be parents. They just needed to be big people who took care of us until we were able to survive on our own. If our big people ignored us, even for a very short period of time, we would, without exception, die. We would succumb to the elements, we would starve to death, we'd be eaten by wild animals. An abandoned infant will die every time, without exception. So surviving this vulnerable phase of our existence was every bit as critical to our staying in the game of evolution as was something like reproduction. Predictably then, natural selection equipped us with an emotion, an urge, that drove us to cling to some big person. What this emotion feels like exactly is impossible to say, because we can't interview infants. But we can make some educated guesses as to what this emotion might feel like based upon what it is that we are getting from the big person that we cling to. And that is security. And not just any old security, but perfect security. Remember, every one of our direct ancestors, without a single exception, survived infancy. That's a perfect record. That's perfect security. Of course, we don't remain infants forever. Eventually, we grow up and begin to develop intellectually. And as we transition into this intellectual phase of our lives, it becomes glaringly obvious that the perfect security we so longed for as children is nowhere to be found in the jungles of reality. Still, that craving for perfect security is still with us. It's an unavoidable part of who we are emotionally. And like any craving, it drives us to engage in behaviors that will satisfy it. Viewed in this context, it's not difficult to see how human beings could be predisposed not to believe in religion or God, per se, but to long for a relationship with some big person capable of satisfying our craving for perfect security. For many people, that big person is God. Not long ago, I accompanied a friend to the hospital. She was having some tests done that involved painkillers and consequently needed somebody to drive her home. While she was being tested, I got to sit in the hospital's waiting room. And like most hospital waiting rooms, this one was well stocked with religious tracts. Since I had a little bit of free time on my hands, I began sifting through these tracts and came upon one titled, Talking to God from a Hospital Bed, written by some guy named John Travokas. I'd like to read a brief excerpt from this tract that I think is revealing. The excerpt says, and I'm quoting here, Relax. Clear your mind. Gaze around you. The nurse has put up the side rails on your bed to make you feel secure, and so that you don't, in your sleep or in your restlessness, roll over and out. You feel good about that, don't you? You feel comforted. You smile to yourself and you say to God, I trust it's not a reversion of my crib days, God, but I must confess that it feels so good to have the sides of my bed pulled up at night. I gaze at the bars, and as my eyes grow heavy, rather than feeling any cooped-up sensation, I rest safe and secure and warm. With you involved in every phase of my life, I'll strive to remember I need never be fearful. I'll try not to forget that in your loving care, the sides are always up. The language employed by the author of this tract speaks volumes. For example, he tells God, I trust it's not a reversion of my crib days, God. You know, frankly, I think that's exactly what it is, a reversion to his crib days, a sort of nostalgia for infancy. He also says to God, With you involved in every phase of my life, I'll strive to remember I need never be fearful. Now think about this. When is the one time in your life when you, one, have some other person involved in every phase of your life, and two, when you felt a sense of perfect security? It was when you were a little baby. A belief in God is an attempt to recapture that feeling of perfect security that we felt as infants and toddlers. Granted, we can't see God. We can't understand God's ways. We don't know where God comes from. But that hardly matters. As infants, we didn't understand how our big people did what they did. Nor did we know where our big people came from. The powers of our big people to affect our security were totally beyond our infant understanding. And there's the word I'm looking for. Understanding. Understanding is not a precondition to experiencing this emotion. And this is the real crux of the matter. You see, our parents or some big person took care of us during that first crucial phase of life. But we did not know how they did it. They took care of us somehow. That's obvious. We survived. We're here. But we had no idea how they pulled this off. In other words, we had no understanding of how they affected our earliest survival. And we didn't need to understand. All we needed to know was that the big person had to be there. That was good enough. We didn't need to make sense of the world in order to feel perfectly safe. In fact, and here's the real clincher, the only way we could feel perfectly safe would be in the absence of understanding. Nothing could be more obvious. I mean, just look at the world we live in. Look at the Holocaust. Look at the Middle East. Look at September the 11th. Just look at childhood. As adults, we now know that our infant phase was not perfectly safe. Children die all the time and for all sorts of reasons. Something else we know as adults, something we didn't know as infants, is that our surviving that early phase of life was not exclusively a function of parental care. Granted, had the big people not done their job, we would have been goners for sure. But our survival was also a function of good genes, environmental conditions, and just plain dumb luck. As we transitioned into adulthood, we brought with us an emotion. An emotion that served us well during the intellectual darkness of infancy. But as we found ourselves thrust into the bright lights of intellectual understanding, this very same emotion caused us to feel like fish out of water. Believing in God is our attempt to return to the water. So here's our situation. We're in a state of conflict. We have two very different desires trying to coexist in our heads at the same time. On the one hand, we have the desire for perfect security rooted in infant emotion. On the other hand, we have the desire for real, true understanding rooted in the adult intellect. It's almost like we have two very different worlds competing for the affection of our minds. These two worlds cannot be reconciled. Hence the conflict. The only way to put an end to this conflict is to let one of these worlds die. If we choose to embrace the imaginary world of perfect security, we must necessarily sacrifice that part of us that understands. In a very real way, we must allow our understanding to die. Now, as harsh as all this must sound, it's an assessment that resonates perfectly with the most fundamental teachings of the world's most influential religions. For example, Christians tell us that we must give our lives to Jesus. Interesting choice of words. In Proverbs 3, verse 5, both Christians and Jews are counseled to, quote, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding," end of quote. In the Islamic religion, the word Muslim literally means one who submits. One who submits his own mind to the will of Allah, to the will of God. Ask a Muslim what he thinks, and he will parrot some passage from the Quran. Ask a Christian what he thinks, and he'll parrot some passage from the Bible. The devout believer has no opinions of his own, at least when it comes to religion. And that's because that thinking part of himself, the understanding, has effectively died, and a book has taken its place. To voluntarily give up one's understanding is a form of suicide. It sounds crazy, I know. But only by sacrificing one's understanding can a person view the events of September 11th or the Holocaust and say, God is in control. With God, we need never be fearful. In God's loving care, the sides are always up. All of this nonsense is a result of conflict. A conflict between our emotional desire for perfect security and our intellectual desire for true understanding. It's a conflict between infant emotion and adult understanding. The religious world has devised two basic techniques for dealing with this conflict. The first technique deals with the intellectual side of this conflict. The second technique addresses the emotional side. Let's look at both of these in some detail. The first technique, the one dealing with the understanding, can be summarized in a single word, faith. Faith is an interesting word. Like the words God and Spirit, faith is another one of those religious words that means different things to different people. Actually, it's even worse than that, because the word faith can mean different things to the same person. Perhaps the most common kind of faith can be summed up in the statement, I can't see God, but I believe in God. My belief in God is a matter of faith. Now, this kind of faith is the intellectual act of believing in something when there is no evidence to support the belief. That's one kind of faith. Here's another kind of faith. Somebody claims to believe in the Bible and insists that the Bible is perfect in its morality and justice. Challenging this claim, we confront the person with a passage from the book of Exodus, chapter 31, verse 14, which reads, and I quote, "Observe the Sabbath, because it is holy to you. Anyone who desecrates it must be put to death," unquote. After confronting the believer with this passage, We ask him how killing a Sabbath breaker reconciles with his belief that the Bible is perfect in its morality and justice. At this point, the believer says something like, "Look, we don't know why God does these things. I don't pretend to have all the answers. This is just one of those things we have to accept as a matter of faith." Now, when I confront the believer with this passage, I'm operating under the assumption that in his gut, he really doesn't think killing a Sabbath breaker is moral and just. In fact, if his gut is anything like my gut, he believes that killing a Sabbath breaker is an act of murder. Still, he sticks to his claim that the Bible is perfect in its moral teachings, even after being confronted with clear evidence that his Bible condones and even advocates an act of murder. What we have here, then, is a very different kind of faith than the kind we saw in the first example. In the first example, faith was the intellectual act of believing in something for which there is no supporting evidence. In the second example, faith is the intellectual act of believing in something in the presence of evidence that contradicts the belief. These are two very different intellectual acts. They're as different as night and day. Yet these two very different acts are identified with just one word: faith. And herein lies the sleight of hand. Because the religious world lumps both acts under the umbrella of faith, the impression is created that both acts involve the very same intellectual process. Accordingly, the distinction between these two very different intellectual acts is effectively blurred. One thing I think is worth asking ourselves here is this: are either of these intellectual acts desirable? The reason I ask this is because faith, and especially religious faith, is almost universally believed to be a good thing. Because faith is believed to be a good thing, faith is encouraged. But is faith a good thing? Is it a good thing to believe in things for which there is no evidence? Is it a good thing to believe in things that are at odds with the evidence? Well, consider this. In any area of human activity, with the possible exception of religion, we would probably judge a person who believes in things for which there is no evidence as insane. Really? To illustrate, consider the language of the person who claims to have a personal relationship with God. Just turn on your TV sometime to any religious station and listen to how these people describe this relationship. These people talk to God. God talks back to them, or so they tell us. God helps these people with their family lives and their financial lives. God protects them on trips away from home and helps them to play their best at football games. God is involved in pretty much every aspect of their lives. And the vast majority of the world sees absolutely nothing wrong with this. In fact, here in the United States, this is thought to be very healthy behavior. Now imagine how we would view this very same person if everywhere the person says God, we insert the name Napoleon. How would we view a person who claims to have a close personal relationship with Napoleon? That he talks to Napoleon. That Napoleon talks back to him. That Napoleon helps him with his family life and his financial life. That Napoleon protects his family on trips and helps him to play his best at football games. That Napoleon helped him to meet his soulmate on a bus. That Napoleon cures his back pain. I mean, what would we think of a person who talked like this? We'd think the person was nuts. Ah, but not so if the person is talking to God. Even though we have more evidence for the existence of Napoleon than we do for the existence of God. My mother recently purchased a new home, and I was with her when she arranged for the financing with the mortgage company. At one point, we met with the owner of the mortgage company, a real nice lady, and during our discussion, Mom asked the lady how long she had owned the company. She told us that she had started the company about a year earlier. She also told us that her reason for starting the company was because God spoke to her one day and told her to start this company. She said God literally spoke to her and told her to start this company. Now, what if she had told us that Elvis had told her to start this company? Let's not mince words here, folks. In any area of life other than religion, when people carry on conversations with invisible people, we think they're just a few beers short of a six-pack. Yet if these conversations take place in the context of religious faith, the person is thought to be perfectly healthy. Consider, too, the even more disturbing concept of criminal insanity. In the eyes of the law, a person is judged to be criminally insane if, due to some mental defect, at the time of the crime, the person was unable to understand the difference between right and wrong. But isn't an inability to distinguish right from wrong exactly what we see in the person who defends the stoning of a Sabbath breaker? In any other context, killing someone for simply doing a little yard work on the Sabbath would be viewed as a moral atrocity. Yet when seen through the eyes of faith, this act of murder is magically transformed into an act of justice. Seen through the eyes of faith, wrong becomes right. While faith may not make a person physically insane in the sense of brain damage insane, it can make him functionally insane. In the case of functional insanity, there's nothing physically wrong with the person's brain. He just acts as though there is. Or at least he talks as though there is. Now, these are some pretty harsh words I'm using here, but I think these words are well deserved. I think religious faith is a bad thing. Even so, promoters of religion have effectively convinced the world that faith is a good thing. Now, how do they pull this off? The answer? More sleight of hand. Watch this. So far, we've talked about two kinds of faith. There's the faith of believing in something for which there is no evidence, and there's the faith of believing in something that contradicts evidence. There is a third kind of faith that I haven't mentioned yet. This third kind of faith is really a kind of trust, a reasonable trust. This is the kind of faith that you exercise in the guy flying the plane, so you get on the plane. This is the kind of faith that you have that the sun will rise tomorrow, so you get out of bed to meet a new day. This is the kind of faith that says that you can pass that math test, so you take the test. Unlike the other two kinds of faith, this version of faith has evidence supporting it. You know your pilot has been trained to fly the plane. Therefore, you believe your trip will be safe. You've seen the sunrise every day of your life. Therefore, you believe today will be like every other. You've studied hard for that math test. Therefore, you believe you can pass the test. With this kind of faith, you have reality-based reasons to expect a given outcome. Now, your expectation isn't perfect. That's why we call it faith. There's still a small chance that the plane will crash, that the sun will get sucked into a black hole, or that you will fail your math test. But there is enough evidence behind your expectation to cause you to move ahead with reasonable confidence. This kind of faith is a very positive thing. It gives us reason to take action. This kind of faith is what makes the world go around, kind of like love. If we didn't have this kind of faith, we wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. Without this kind of faith, our world would come to a grinding halt. So again, this kind of faith is a very good thing. But notice that this last kind of faith is light years removed from these other two kinds of faith. Believing in something that is supported by evidence is a very different intellectual act from believing in something with no evidence, or worse yet, believing in something that contradicts evidence. What we have here, then, are three very different intellectual acts. Yet in the religious world, all three of these acts are identified with a single word, faith. Now watch what happens here. Watch this thought process. This last kind of faith, faith as a reasonable trust, is a good thing. Therefore, faith is a good thing. Faith is a good thing. But faith is not merely a reasonable trust. Faith is also the act of believing in things without any evidence. But as we've already established, faith is a good thing. Therefore, believing in things without any evidence is also a good thing. But wait a minute. Faith is also the act of believing in things that conflict with evidence. Therefore, believing in things that conflict with evidence is also a good thing. Can you see what's happening here? The well-deserved reputation of one kind of faith is being plagiarized by the other two. Through an act of verbal sleight of hand, the promoters of religion have made believing in nonsense a virtue. They've made believing in conflict a virtue. And once a person treats conflict as a virtue, he will literally believe anything. He will believe that up is down, that black is white, that the first is last. He will believe that a man was swallowed by a fish, that Jesus walked on water, that the universe was created in 6 days. He will believe the stoning of a Sabbath breaker is an act of justice. He will watch children die of disease, earthquakes take the lives of thousands, jumbo jets slam into buildings. He will watch all of these horrors and insist that God is in control. He will believe that God loves those that he sends to hell. He will believe anything. When a person's mind will accommodate any belief, true understanding can never take hold. This is the death of understanding. Consider what all this means within the context of spirituality. Spirituality, as I've argued here, is that dimension of the human experience arising from one's relationship with reality. One's relationship with reality is a function of one's understanding of reality. Therefore, to the extent that religious faith hinders the acquisition of true understanding, it functions as a barrier to spirituality. So in what may be one of history's greatest ironies, religious faith, traditionally thought to be so essential to spirituality, is in fact its greatest obstacle. Given the formative role that emotion plays in religious faith, one might be tempted to think that emotions and feelings play no part in the life of the spiritual atheist. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is true understanding and there is false understanding. True understanding is the goal of the spiritual atheist. As I hope I made clear earlier, true understanding is extremely useful. But true understanding is more than just useful. It has a certain feel to it. True understanding resonates with reality. And it resonates with reality because it is grounded in reality. It is in tune with reality. It fits with reality. As a consequence, true understanding possesses a feeling of stability that is simply absent in false understanding. This feeling of stability is a result of two things: expectation and confirmation. Think once again of a map. The details of your map create expectations in your mind about a certain territory. Imagine that you're in an unfamiliar city and you want to find the library. You don't know your way around, so you buy a map. You note that according to the map, the library is located 3 blocks to the north of your present location. Now at this point, a feeling of expectation has been created in your mind. The expectation being that if you walk 3 blocks to the north, you will find a library. Now if you do walk 3 blocks to the north, and sure enough you happen upon a building that you recognize to be a library, then your expectation has just been confirmed. Your expectation of reality has been confirmed by your experience of reality. Notice that confirmation is a function of fit. I don't know the neurological details behind this, but clearly your brain looks for some critical mass of correspondence between your expectation and your experience. And when it detects that correspondence, your brain signals, "Bingo, we have a match." That's the experience of confirmation. And for reasons that no doubt have roots in our evolutionary past, this experience of confirmation has a certain emotional feel to it. It feels stable. But what happens if we walk 3 blocks to the north and discover not a library, but a zoo? What happens is that we don't get this feeling of confirmation. Our expectation of reality has not been confirmed by our experience of reality. Now at this point we have two options. The first option is to admit that our map is mistaken and conclude that, for now at least, we don't know where the library is or even if there is a library. We are left in a state of ignorance. This state of ignorance has a feeling all its own, a feeling characterized by an absence of confirmation. Now, our second option will probably seem a little bizarre, but in the context of our present discussion, it's an option that we are forced to consider. This second option is to believe that the map is correct, in spite of the fact that our map has brought us to a zoo and not a library. In this case, we force ourselves to pretend that the zoo in front of us is really a library. This second option produces its own unique feeling, a feeling of conflict. The sensation here is beyond a mere absence of confirmation. The sensation here is clash. Reality is telling us one thing, but we are forcing ourselves to believe, quote-unquote believe, something else. Now listen to these words I'm using here. Clash, force, conflict. In a sense, we are waging war on reality. So to summarize, what we have here are three very different sensations. We have confirmation, an absence of confirmation, and conflict. In our quest for true understanding, we need to recognize these three distinct sensations and what each one represents. True understanding is characterized by the presence of confirmation and the absence of conflict. True understanding is desirable for a couple of reasons. First, it's useful. It can be counted upon to help us navigate our way through the real world and to even thrive in it. But true understanding is more than just useful. As I indicated earlier, true understanding resonates with reality. It fills us with confidence. Put another way, true understanding just flat out feels better than false understanding. Now it's important to note that true understanding does not imply complete understanding. It doesn't mean an absence of ignorance. Ignorance is unavoidable. We're human. But ignorance need not be a source of conflict. Conflict occurs only when we attempt to believe things that are at odds with reality. Again, true understanding is the goal of the spiritual atheist. The way to achieve true understanding is to exercise your capacity to distinguish among these three sensations and then use these sensations as a standard against which to judge the truth or falsity of a particular belief. Exercising your capacity to make these distinctions is really what thinking for yourself is all about. Now, in sharp contrast to thinking for oneself, religious faith requires the individual to effectively swear an oath of loyalty to some belief, and then cling to that belief regardless of the sensations that accompany it. Religious faith is really a sort of bad habit. It's the habit of repeatedly suppressing the mind's natural capacity to distinguish between confirmation and conflict. The strength of a person's religious faith is equal to his capacity to stomach conflict. And it's this willingness to stomach conflict and to even embrace conflict that opens the door to false understanding. Now, if you suspect that I'm building a straw man here, then I would ask you to consider once again the case of the stoning of a Sabbath breaker. Listen to me here. A committed believer in the Bible will refuse to acknowledge the immorality of this obvious act of murder. He is embracing conflict. So this is not a straw man. This is a real condition of real people, and it's kind of scary. A willingness to embrace false understanding is the first step down the slippery slope of spiritual decay. And once again, we are confronted with the irony of how religious faith can be the single greatest obstacle to the spiritual life. Now, if it looks like I'm beating up on religion here, that's because I am. But I'm not doing it just to beat up on religion. The message here is that you don't have to live like this. You don't have to embrace conflict. You can rid yourself of this frustration. But you have to allow yourself the luxury of relinquishing ideas that are clearly absurd. Ideas like stoning Sabbath breakers to death.